This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. A Wisconsin Supreme Court decision in 2012 has complicated the way people with severe dementia are able to be cared for outside of the home. While the state of Wisconsin's Department of Health Services is working on the issue, it's becoming enough of a problem in the La Crosse area that a community conversation is planned for later this month. It's designed to talk about what can be done to help people with dementia and their families who are seeing fewer options. Our guest is Lakeview Health Center Administrator Wanda Placecki, who's organizing the event. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked her to talk about the Supreme Court decision and the effect it's had on dementia care.
The Supreme Court came out with a decision, the Helen EF decision, that primarily said that a person that has a dementia diagnosis without a co-occurring mental illness cannot be served in an institutional setting under what's called a Chapter 51. And that's because dementia typically is not considered to be a treatable illness. And so because of that, Chapter 51, they believe, did not provide the mechanism to provide the services that were needed. They do have, there's another statute called the Chapter 55 that they felt would provide for enough provisions under their emergency protective placement provisions to better serve those individuals. They weren't saying that the individuals didn't need emergency services. They were just saying that the way that the state of Wisconsin had typically looked at it in the past was not appropriate anymore. And primarily they did that, I believe, for a couple of reasons, but mostly it's because under the Chapter 55 there are more provisions that protect an individual's right. So they didn't want to make sure that they wanted to make sure that the person had all of those provisions in place, that if they were if they did require that emergency protective placement, that there would be enough rights and provisions in place for protections for them.
Before we go on, could you kind of define what Chapter 51 is versus Chapter 55?
Chapter 51 is typically a statute that's used to provide for services for a person that has more mental health diagnoses. So a Chapter 55 is really part of that protective placement and that provision for people with that maybe are not able to, that are not competent, that aren't able to take care of themselves. Under Chapter 51, they may or may not be competent to make their own decisions, but they are not making good decisions. They have a treatable illness, and so that provision allows them to receive services that they may not want, but that they need. Under the Chapter 55, it's more of that long-term type of service. So a person needs those protective placement types of services because perhaps they are not competent to make them.
So the Supreme Court decision essentially made it a little easier for courts to determine that people with severe Alzheimer's are now Chapter 51?
No, they would be a Chapter 55.
Chapter 55, mm-hmm.
Correct.
What impact has the decision had on Alzheimer's care in Wisconsin?
I think initially people were concerned that across the state that would then prohibit facilities from accepting them under those emergency protective placements because we don't really have those types of facilities. Now, under the provision, under the statute, every county is required to designate an emergency protective placement facility. Most counties have not. Most counties typically in the past have used hospital settings, those psych units that they maybe are using as an emergency under the Chapter 51 setting, but that really doesn't always work for a person with dementia that doesn't have a co-occurring mental illness. So even though there's a provision in the law that says every county must have one of these, the reality is most do not. And La Crosse County and the surrounding counties typically have used both hospital psych units in the past to provide those types of services. Once they really weren't an option, then they did not have another good option. And part of that is because under the emergency protective placement designation, you have to be able to rule out any medical causes of the behavior or that symptom at the same time, and you have to be able to obtain all of the legal interventions. So you have to be able to get the psych evals, the medical evaluations, all of those things, and then provide for that emergency services at any time of the day or night. And that really doesn't fit very well in other types of settings.
Is Lakeview in West Salem designated by the courts at all?
No, we are a regional facility that has a very long history of providing services to people with challenging behavioral symptoms, but we have not been designated as an emergency protective placement facility at this time.
Is that something you would welcome?
We are interested in looking at that, but part of it is us trying to figure out how we would rule out the medical pieces of that. We can do parts of that, but we can't do it all. It would take more of a community kind of discussion and figuring out how we're going to do that as a community. But yes, we are potentially could be one of those sites.
I assume you have some challenging Alzheimer's patients.
Mm-hmm.
At Lakeview, correct? How do you deal with them right now?
Well, we have always taken care of people with challenging behavioral symptoms. And I would say that almost all of our residents could meet that designation. We typically have been able to take care of people in a variety of ways, but for us, it starts with training for our staff. So our staff do receive specialized training that's provided for by our social workers. We also have specially trained staff that we call qualified mental health professionals that we can provide an extra layer of behavioral support. Because we are a county facility and actually work with 13 member counties, we do also have access to other types of support through a mobile crisis at the County Human Services. We've got access, I think, greater access to some of the resources within the community. So we do many things, but part of it starts, again, with that staff training. We also do a very good assessment with our residents so that we have a good understanding. The better we get to know that person and who they are, we can figure out why maybe some causes for that behavior. We look at behavior as typically it's communication and it's trying to figure out what that unmet need is, whether or not it's pain, whether or not it's fear, whether or not it's I just don't know what's going on and so you need to help me figure this out. We understand that behavior is not personal. It is really trying to identify what that unmet need is and then giving that person what they need prior to that behavior getting out of hand or becoming dangerous.
So what have the last 2 years meant for the care of people with dementia?
For us, the challenge has been in the past, we've been able to accept people that have challenging behaviors, knowing that if they would become unsafe in our environment, which is still licensed as a nursing home, that there would be options for them for short-term placement. So we knew that if we needed to, they could maybe go into the hospital for some more intense medication adjustments. They could go to another regional type of facility, and there are several around the state that are considered to be geropsych units. We could have sent them there. We could have gotten those resources and then had them come back to our facility a little more stable. Now, because of that Helen EF, we really are not able to do that. There aren't really those places that will accept them. So once an individual comes into our facility, they are ours. And that can be I would say scary for us as a facility because at some point they may not be safe in our facility and we need to have options for them to get the care that's most appropriate at that time.
What has the impact been on families in the La Crosse area?
I think the unintended impact has been that families are struggling to meet those needs. They want to keep their family member home as long as possible. So typically, they don't even consider other placement until there's a lot going on, especially in the area of those behavioral symptoms. And when I'm looking at behavioral symptoms, we really talk about a lot of different types of behaviors. They could be things like aggression, physical aggression. They could be things like yelling out. They could be things like sundowning behaviors where a person gets more confused into the late afternoon, early evenings. But they might be just things like refusing to take their medications or just just not being willing, maybe hoarding behaviors, those types of things, confabulation where they are talking about things that are really not true, but they are true in their reality. And families really are struggled. They don't have the expertise in it. They see the changes in their family member. It's very personally distressing, and sometimes it's not safe for the individual. But now they can't just go to the hospital. They can't just call us up. You know, there's more of a process now. And so I think for them, it means they've been struggling silently for a lot longer period of time now.
It's hard to talk about healthcare and just generalize about it. Could you give us an anecdote or two that you've seen the last couple of years? And please keep names out of it. But just in general terms, what types of stories are people going through?
Well, I think I have heard more stories coming to us at the time of a referral for a resident. So people that are not our residents, but that we're getting calls from the hospital, and we're taking a look at that individual, and we're saying they seem to be too acute for us at this time, but they're sitting on a medical floor, or they've come in after a fall maybe from another facility, and that facility can't take them back. And now they've been at the hospital for 30 days, 60 days, 100 days. Sometimes I think I can think of an individual who actually did go home. The family took him home. And, you know, that didn't work out. That was not very safe. So they ended up, because we have two hospital systems, they ended up at the other facility. And that then again became another process. And we took a look for a long time. We would go visit that person. We would always make sure we had updated notes. But because of this fear that we wouldn't be able to care for that person over the long haul and over that long term, we weren't comfortable in accepting that person for admission. And so that person, that individual, had a long period of time in a medical facility before they were able to get to a nursing home. And that's not a very positive experience for anyone. Certainly the hospitals are not your home. They are not where people are expecting to go for long periods of time. So that is one. But I think I can think of other phone calls that we've had from family members saying, I'm not sure what I need to do. Do you know of places that we could look at? Are there places in the area? So we've had more and more of those types of phone calls. We have also been asked by other facilities that have struggled now. Typically, other more traditional nursing homes, if they've needed to, they've been able to look at a discharge and an admission to another more appropriate setting. That doesn't always work. So we've actually sent our staff out into other facilities and other places to help, you know, kind of with that education and training and support as well we can. Families are struggling. I think other facilities are struggling. We are struggling in order to provide that kind of safe care, which oftentimes means one-to-one enhanced supervision, where you might be one staff person with a resident. That's not very cost effective. And many times it's not what the resident wants. I would not appreciate having somebody with me all the time, 100% of the time, and these individuals do not also.
What level of care does someone with really severe dementia need?
Oftentimes, as a person moves through those stages of dementia, what they need are people who really know them, who know what triggers might be out there, ways to intervene prior to those things happening. So they need someone who knows them well, who has a passion for working with those people. And sometimes it's someone who's present. So it's not typically for us, when we're looking at an enhanced supervision, they're not necessarily nurses. They may not be social workers. They are not people that are trained at that level. But they are people that have that extra training and have this knowledge of the residents. So we typically use people, we would use our CNAs, so our certified staff at that level, but it's meaning we need a lot of them. And right now, that's not the case in the La Crosse community. It's difficult to find even that level of staff to provide 24-hour care in that area.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking with Lakeview Healthcare Administrator Wanda Blachecki about the difficulty in Wisconsin placing some people with dementia in facilities outside the home. What is this meant for healthcare institutions in the La Crosse area, the two we have?
Well, I think if you asked them, and we will be talking about this on the 26th at our community conversation, but I think if you asked them, it would mean that they are being asked to provide a type of care that they're not equipped to provide. It's not acute medical care. It is more of that long-term services. And the hospitals, that's not what they're designed to do. And so I think that that's probably one of their challenges, as well as for all of us, it's that how are we getting paid for this? Because if that person does not require that acute medical, or if they don't require services for a nursing home, what is that level of reimbursement, and is it adequate to cover the cost of that service? So I think typically it's knowing that the person is in a setting that they don't need, and that those staff are not equipped to provide. I think that's been the challenge. But I have seen, at least anecdotally, sometimes 4, 5, and 6 individuals with dementia without a co-occurring mental illness that might be in the hospital settings at one time. That's a challenge for the system.
And once again, the hospitals are being asked to become long-term providers. Why?
Because there isn't an appropriate placement for them elsewhere. You know, in the past, they could go to a geropsych unit. They could go to some of these places. They could have come to our facility sometimes. But with the regulatory environment the way it is, people are hesitant under the current regulations for nursing homes to take individuals that may have significant behaviors. And by that, I mean things like physical aggression, things like sometimes the medications that you're on. Under the nursing home regulations, we have a requirement to have people on as few of medications as possible. And the use of antipsychotics for people with dementia is strongly discouraged. And as they come to us from the hospital setting, we are looking at trying to figure out a way to stabilize people, but yet not use those types of medications. Especially in the nursing home environment, it's very difficult. And so it makes it more challenging. So I think the services that were available in just general settings in the community, plus the lack of those geropsych units being available to individuals with significant behaviors and a dementia diagnosis.
So what is the State Department of Health Services doing about this situation?
DHS has made a strong commitment to helping to build a more dementia-capable system within the state of Wisconsin. And they have chosen to start that process really and to focus a lot on training. And when I say training, I'm not just talking about provider training. I'm talking about training to families, training to law enforcement, training to other types of ancillary services that might be out there. And they've started with really just trying to give people an overview of what that dementia diagnosis can mean, what types of dementia we might be talking about, and then what are some approaches to, you know, that system. And they've looked at things like the Silver Alert, which I think is a fairly new system to help with people who may wander and become lost. So I think that they've tried to focus on trying to promote that system. They've focused on the development of that training. And then they have some other work groups that are looking at things like challenging behaviors and those types of things, and crisis services, those things. But they have made a commitment to doing that with the recognition that there aren't additional resources available.
So it sounds like it's kind of a slow process.
That's correct.
And is that what we need now, is a slow process, or would loosening some regulations help and allow facilities like yours and others to take these patients mm-hmm. back again?
Mm-hmm. I think that we have talked to the department about what other types of regulations people, what types of settings we might develop. The challenge with the nursing home setting is that it's federally and state regulated, and the federal regulations are not going to move. We know it takes a long time to have a state regulation change, it even longer and more challenging for the federal. So I think the nursing home environment may not be the best setting for these types of individuals. So the state has been willing to discuss different types of options. And one of the things that we have done, I have had the opportunity to meet with the department staff a few times about what some of those options might be. And again, it's going to be something different for every community. But if there was a different type of licensure that would allow, again, more ability to provide some of those services to individuals as they need them, that I think is a key component. So we are continuing to look at that. I mean, part of the community conversation in January will be to figure out what is it that we need so we can go back and ask them to maybe help us figure out how to regulate and license that.
So who is invited to this community conversation, and what are you hoping to accomplish?
A lot of people are invited. I think it seems to be growing every day. But it initially started with conversations that I had both at the state level, but also with both hospital systems. Dr. Thomas Lofi is our medical director. He is from the Mayo system. And then we've been talking with Gunderson staff, again, because of specific individual issues that we've had and referrals that we've had. So we've been talking with both systems for several months now and decided that getting a group of stakeholders together would be a very important piece of that process, starting that conversation. Who is invited would, again, be both hospital systems, a group of providers from the region. And when I say region, I'm including Vernon, Monroe, Trempealeau, and La Crosse counties. So we've invited all the county facilities because they typically have a little bit more of a mission to provide that care. We are inviting also some of the larger assisted living providers and nursing home providers in the area. We've invited the county human services directors, their aging departments, the ADRCs, so those types of staff, the mobile crisis teams, we've tried to have some representation from that. We're looking at wanting to have some law enforcement representation because, again, that's a key component. The vast majority of people that we're talking about are not living in the nursing home or assisted living setting. They're at home right now. So we want to make sure that we have some good representation from the advocacy groups like the Alzheimer's Association, and perhaps we really would like some actual family members and caregivers.
The idea being to come up with some sort of a regional suggestion for ways we can deal with this. I know La Crosse County has been quite creative in the last couple of decades and doing pilot programs that other regions of the state are not doing. Is that sort of the idea, is to come up with a pilot program that you can do and maybe test for the rest of the state?
I think that is something that the state would be very interested in if we could present to them some very concrete ideas. So, yes, part of that challenge or the agenda includes us figuring out what the issues are. Because, again, I know we're coming together because of crisis, but that's just a small piece of what's going on in terms of developing a dementia-capable community. So we'll start with that, figuring out what's working, what resources we have, how could we work together, and what do we want. And I think that's it. You always need to have the ask at the end.
How big is the problem in this region?
Well, I think that there's a growing number of individuals in our communities that have a diagnosis of dementia, that are struggling. Either they might be just diagnosed, newly diagnosed, figuring out what resources are available, all the way through that process where maybe they are really needing some additional supports. So I think it's a growing, you know, again, as we get older, the chances of us all developing some kind of dementia grows as we get older. And so our communities, as they get older, also we're going to see that. But when we're talking about what really take up, I would say, the vast amount of people resources and financial resources, it is really still a very small number of people.
Is there anything else you want to add, Wanda?
I think what I would like to say is that La Crosse County as a community does know how to come together. They do know how to identify issues and come up with creative solutions. And I'm very confident that we will have a good start to this on January 26th.
Is this a problem in other states as well or just Wisconsin?
This is a national issue.
Wanda Placecki is the administrator at Lakeview Health Center in West Salem. She's organizing a community conversation later this month to talk about the difficulty finding a healthcare facility for people with severe dementia. About 40 to 50 people are expected to attend the January 26th conversation that is not open to everyone. She says if someone wants to attend, they should contact her at Lakeview Health Center in West Salem. She spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Coming up, we'll talk with a Minnesota law professor who's been an advocate for Native American women who are victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website at WPR.org/newsmakers. There, you'll also find a link to a pair of reports on Alzheimer's care in Wisconsin done by the Alzheimer's Challenging Behaviors Task Force. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, American Indian and Alaskan Native women are more likely to experience a physical assault compared to women of other races. While many are striving to end the violence, Sarah Deer is working with tribal nations to address the high rate of violence and protect victims. She was a professor of law at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul and citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. Deer also recently received the MacArthur Fellowship Program Award, also known as the Genius Award, and she was recently a speaker at UW La Crosse. So, Sarah, I'm wondering if you can just first help us understand why is it that Native American women may be more likely to experience domestic abuse, sexual violence, other types of violence in their lifetime?
There's no quick and easy answer to that question, but it seems to me, and this is based on the research I've done, that when perpetrators are not held accountable for their behavior, their abusive behavior, their behavior continues, and it sends messages to others in the community. So what we have seen is basically a breakdown of criminal justice for Native women, which sends a message then to both victims and perpetrators that the system is not going to protect the people who are abused.
So let's maybe break down some of those systems that come into play. If a woman is abused on tribal land, her abuser may be tried in a tribal court. Can you explain how tribal courts are set up then?
Well, each tribal court's a little different. And the basic concept is that tribes retain the inherent authority that they've always had. So jurisdiction hasn't been given to us as tribes. We already have it. And so some tribes exercise criminal jurisdiction, meaning that they prosecute and convict. Some tribes limit their hearings to just things involving family law. But some tribes do everything, just like a state. Just like a state court would, they hear family law and property disputes and contracts. And so it depends on the tribe. But those tribes that prosecute, that actually take action in criminal matters, have certain restrictions on what they can and can't do. And some of that explains the high rate of violence because of those restrictions.
So let's talk about those restrictions and maybe historically how they've been set up and how they've played out in some of the tribal courts.
Well, I think probably the most important law that affects Indian tribes today actually comes out of a U.S. Supreme Court case. And a not very long ago Supreme Court case in 1978. And what the Supreme Court ruled is that tribes can't prosecute non-Indians. So if you are not a tribal member and you go onto a reservation and you commit a crime, any crime from burglary to murder, the tribe doesn't have the authority to prosecute you.
But then could the county or the state step in?
Sure. The way the structure is set up is that depending on the tribe, you have shared jurisdiction with either the federal government or the state government. In Wisconsin, it's largely the state government, with the exception of the Menominee Nation, which has a federal structure. So the idea is that if a non-Indian committed a crime against a Native woman on Indian land, the state would come in and prosecute that case. Historically, that hasn't worked well. I think in recent years, and particularly in Wisconsin, we've seen a great improvement in that relationship. But in other states, it hasn't worked as well. And tribes are really suffering because they can't hold people accountable.
And as you said, because of that history of not being able to hold people accountable, the perpetrators, this is one of the reasons that Native American women have experienced more violence?
Absolutely. I think that's a good explanation. It's not the only explanation. But when women report crime and nothing happens, they stop reporting. And nobody can prosecute if they don't know of the crime. So Native women in some places have lost trust in the system and would rather sort of suffer in silence rather than try to engage with the criminal justice system.
Do you ever find that maybe non-Native perpetrators, are they attracted ever to Native women or know that maybe they can get away with things easier on tribal land and so they go there?
There's definitely some evidence of that. There's evidence of targeting Native women. There's also evidence of child predators researching the laws and selecting locations where they know that the system maybe is broken. We also see this with international drug trafficking rings, particularly down in the Southwest. Several organized crime rings from Mexico have selected Indian reservations for their meth manufacturing and distribution because the law enforcement there is so sparse. So it's not just violence against women. It's a large range of different crimes that are very, very they're very detrimental to Native people.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, my guest is Sarah Deer. She's a professor at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul and an advocate for victims of domestic violence, especially on Native American reservations. You talked a bit about abusers who are non-Native, who hurt Native American women. What about tribal members who are abusers on tribal land?
Native men commit these crimes too. And sometimes I think we lose that a little bit because a lot of our national work has focused on the non-Indian perpetrators for good reason because of the sort of jurisdictional problem. But Native men have committed these crimes and many of them have not been held accountable by the tribal system, by the state system. And that's another way that women suffer in silence because the fear you don't turn in your own. Right? Native men are already incarcerated at a very, very high percentage. And so there's some, like I think any marginalized community, some discomfort in perpetuating that. And so when we have that kind of violence happen, there's another sort of silence that comes with it. But what's great about the last few years is Native men have really stepped up. Social media has been a great platform for Native men to say this is not acceptable in our community.
So once an abuser does go through the court system, the tribal court system, can you talk about the – you said there are some limits when it comes to prosecution. What are those limits? And obviously every case is different. What can an abuser see?
The maximum until last year or a few years ago actually was a one-year maximum. For any crime, that includes homicide, sexual abuse, child abuse. The federal government had limited the ability of tribes to incarcerate for more than a year. We were able to see some good news, some success in 2010. We were able to convince Congress that that wasn't long enough for some of these crimes. And so now tribes are able to sentence to up to 3 years per offense for a maximum of 9 years. Now, that's still not equivalent to what a state can do if you have, say, a child sexual predator. 9 years doesn't seem like enough. But from a tribal perspective, it's an improvement. I mean, at least that child will be safe for 9 years, but he's going to come back.
Do you know why the federal government had such, I guess, differentiating limits on mm-hmm. those sentencing?
Well, the sentencing limitation comes from actually a federal law in 1968. And Congress appeared to be concerned that tribal courts were not fair, that tribal courts violated civil liberties, that tribal courts were not held to the same standard as state courts. And so as part of a package to deal with that, they said no more than 1 year because the concern about tribal courts not being sophisticated enough to be fair to all the parties.
Wow. And if I'm not mistaken, you were pretty instrumental in helping to change some of these federal rules. Am I correct?
I think, yes, I played a role, but I think more importantly, it was grassroots Native women's activism that changed the law. I researched about it and wrote about it, but the hard work is really done by the Native women who work on this issue every day. And so I was part of that. But identifying and researching the cause of the problem is sort of my contribution, and Congress did step up and listen for the first time in about 100 years.
And did a lot of this stem from the Amnesty International report that you had worked on? And I guess maybe you could tell people a bit about that.
Sure. I had the opportunity to partner with Amnesty International back in, I would say, about 10 years ago, 2005. And for 2 years, we researched and created a report called Maze of Injustice, which was released in spring of 2007. And that report humanized the data that we had. It told the stories of Native women and had pictures of them, right, rather than the data. And Congress noticed. The United States is often held up to be sort of the model of how human rights are to be respected, but we don't often look at ourselves. And so it was one of the first reports that Amnesty did about the United States as a violator of human rights. And the federal government responded, which sort of surprised me.
Sure.
But it really did wake some folks up on the Hill, and conversations started that hadn't started before.
Because one of the statistics that came out of that report that is shocking is that 1 in 3 Native women will be sexually assaulted in her lifetime.
Yes. That data comes from federal government statistics, and it's not a fluke. It's aggregate over about a 10-year period.
And I'm assuming those are only reported?
Well, yes, to some extent. There are people who are willing to share that they've experienced it. I think the rate is much higher. I think the rate is probably closer to 50% to 80% based on my research and my travels. And Obama, President Obama, when he signed the law in 2010 to change the sentencing authority, he said the fact that 1 in 3 Native women will be raped in her lifetime should shock our nation's conscience. And not only was that the first time I'd ever heard a president say anything about Native women, but he acknowledged the harm that has been done. And symbolically, that was huge.
So the sentencing changes came about, sort of spiraled out of that report and then the other work that is being done. Were other policy changes made as a result of that?
Yes. So we have the 2010 law that changed the sentencing, and then the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization, which was a battle. That was a really tough battle, but finally signed into law in March of 2013, allows tribes to prosecute non-Indians for the first time since 1978. It's limited to domestic violence, so things like child abuse are still not covered. But no one thought it could be done, and it happened. So, and I got to be there when the president signed the bill in 2013. Now we're working on the implementation.
I mean, what was that like, just knowing that the federal government, that the president finally had your attention on such a big issue?
It was validating. I think for many Native women who have worked on this issue for decades, it was validating, but at the same time a little frustrating, like, we've been saying these same things for years. But President Obama did make Native issues a primary issue in his platform, and he made good on his word.
So now that non-Native abusers, probably mostly men, can be tried in a tribal court, what sort of difference does that make for victims of domestic violence?
Well, it will make a difference for many, not all, because you still have the issue of people feeling like they're at fault, they're to blame. But for women who are in abusive relationships, or men who are in abusive relationships with non-Indians, there's more options now. And sometimes options for victims are really important, even if you don't go down that road, just that you have the option.
Do you think that it will make a major difference in ending or, you know, trying to cut back on domestic violence within tribal communities?
I do. I think it's too soon to know the extent of the reform and how much it will change. But I don't see it backfiring. I can't figure out a way that it would actually make things worse. So I'm hopeful that in the next few years we'll have some data to bear out the successes of the reform.
And it's interesting, as you said, that this only addresses being able to try non-Native people who have committed domestic violence. And it's just so interesting to me that it's limited at just that, while so many other things could happen.
Well, we started out with a bigger ask, but politically it was really hard to convince some of our legislators that this was truly a problem that needed to be addressed. And so by making the story about abusers who married into the tribe or lived in the tribe or had children that were members of the tribe, that was hard to ignore. And so politically, that was salvageable, whereas some of the other pieces we were asking for were not.
I know it all comes down to politics, but in your mind, what is the holdup to expand this to, you know, offer more protections?
I think there's still a lot of myths and stereotypes about Native people. I think a lot of people are afraid of tribal courts because they don't know what they are. They don't know if they're fair. And so the idea that somebody who's not from that community could be held accountable in a courtroom is really uncomfortable to a lot of folks. I think it's just a matter of education and for folks to see that tribal courts are fair and have due process. But there's a lot of mythology about it.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, my guest is Sarah Deer. She's a professor of law at the William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul and an advocate for victims of domestic violence on Native American reservations. She is also a member and a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. Beyond what's going on in the court system, the tribal court system on reservations, what else are different tribal nations doing to address domestic violence within their community?
It's really exciting to see the different things that are happening out in tribal communities. A lot of awareness, a lot of speak outs, a lot of walks, a lot of really thinking about how we want to be as Native people. So language comes into it, culture comes into it. And for the first time, I think in a long time, Native women really believe that their systems will change and that people will be held accountable. So the energy is very uplifting, even though the topic is really distressing. The energy is very optimistic.
So I'm assuming some of it is stopping that cycle of abuse, but also maybe encouraging women to speak up if they do find themselves to be a victim?
Yes, to
which
say...
Which can't be easy.
It is never easy for any victim, whatever your race is, to come forward because of the shame and the guilt and the kinds of blame that society puts on victims. But Native women are not complacent and passive, despite the stereotypes. And so now that the systems are being reformed, Native women are saying, you don't have to speak out, but if you do, there will be a system in place to help you.
So you were here in La Crosse talking with students and community members on campus. You gave the speech, Decolonizing the Rape Law, a Native Feminist Synthesis of Safety and Sovereignty. And it was interesting because you gave the talk on what has been historically known as Columbus Day. There's obviously this move to have it more known as Indigenous Peoples Day. Just the timing for you, was that kind of interesting?
Yes, it certainly is. I have been doing more of the Indigenous Peoples Day talks in my different travels. But what a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of Columbus bashing and from the tribal communities, tribal people think, you know, saying Columbus was not a good man. But from a woman's perspective, there is ample evidence from the shipmates themselves that they felt entitled to Native women's bodies. The second journey, there's a journal entry bragging of the kidnapping and rape of a Native woman. So the image of Columbus for Native women is not just sort of the entry point for colonization and destruction of Indian nations, but actually very personal about the violation of our bodies. And so that when you associate that with Columbus, it becomes even more sort of sinister. And that's why I'm so happy that many campuses and local communities are rethinking Columbus Day.
And I'm wondering if you can maybe explain that rethinking of Columbus Day to people who aren't familiar with people in communities who are trying to push this more.
Well, Columbus Day has been celebrated for many years as sort of the discovery of the Americas. And Native people have always pushed back on that, like, how can you discover us if we're already here? And Columbus really introduced a lot of disease, slavery. He took slaves back to Europe. And that part of the story often isn't told. We hear about his bravery, his discovery, but that's really just part of the picture. So rethinking Columbus Day is about acknowledging that painful part of the past and sort of thinking about how we celebrate Native people. We don't have a holiday for Native people. So
it's kind of wild.
Right. And so maybe rethinking Columbus Day and replacing it with something that focuses on the vibrancy and the resilience of Native people. And it's really validating to see that happen.
You say it's validating to have an Indigenous People's Day or any other sort of holiday, month, whatever label you want to put on it. I mean, how much of a difference could that make for Native communities throughout this country?
Well, indifference is a huge problem that we experience. And indifference, I think, doesn't come from a lack of compassion, but from just not knowing. I have law students who have lived in this part of the country their entire lives that don't really have any understanding of the history of Native people. And it's not really their fault in the sense that if they're not exposed to it, they can't learn about it. But celebrating our survival, celebrating our resilience is something that gets attention. And hopefully that will help more people learn about the history of their communities and the tribes that belong to those communities.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, my guest is Sarah Deer. She's a professor of law at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul and an advocate for victims of domestic violence on Native American reservations. She's also a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. You received the MacArthur Fellowship Program Award, better known as the Genius Award, mm-hmm. which seems like an incredibly wonderful accomplishment.
It was very surprising.
Really?
That's sort of how that's their shtick, right? They keep it a secret until the very last minute, and then suddenly your life changes.
You just get the phone call and say, you are a genius, Sarah.
Well, yeah, basically, yes. That's how it goes down. And no forewarning at all. Didn't even know I had been nominated. Didn't even know I was in the running. So your life changes pretty quickly in a span of a couple of minutes. And I'm still sort of coming down from that. And I wasn't allowed to tell anyone for 2 weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
So except my husband. Mm-hmm. And today's my 14th wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
So I called him, and he works in the same building. So he came up, and then we said, well, we're not allowed to tell anyone else for 2 weeks. And that was really hard. And so by the time it actually got publicly announced, I was sort of used to the idea. And then I had all of these folks come to my office and the phone calls and the emails. And it was just overwhelming and still is to some extent overwhelming to think that my work has made that kind of difference to get that kind of recognition.
And you're one of 21 fellows across the nation who received this award. Can you explain to people who may not be familiar with the Genius Award what it is and maybe why people like yourself are selected for it?
Well, in short, it's $625,000 with no strings attached. That's it in a nutshell. But they recognize folks from all different fields. So you have anywhere from choreographers to physicists to law professors. Any field is open. And the MacArthur Foundation researches top people in various fields and selects some folks to both reward what they've done in the past and invest to what they might do in the future. So it really is sort of a validation, but also there's some pressure on me now. Like, I have to be a genius now that I have this award. But the entire experience of learning of it and then the accolades that come from friends and family has been, I think, more important than the money.
Well, obviously they selected you as an individual, but a lot of it is a reflection on the work that you've done towards working with victims of violence, especially within the Native American community.
Yes. So there's the piece where, wow, I'm being validated and rewarded, but there's also the piece about all of the Native women, thousands, that have been doing this work who all should be rewarded with this kind of grant. So my goal with this grant is to sort of elevate voices of Native women that haven't been heard. And that might come through, you know, co-authoring a book or creating a film. But I have really all the options I want because there's no strings attached to this money, no reporting, no, you know, no promises. So I really want to listen to Native women. I really want to hear their stories. And I want other people to hear them as well.
And so with that, and for more people to hear Native women's stories, what can come about from something like that?
Again, just breaking that stereotype, breaking that sort of indifference that comes from ignorance, that Native women are here, that we are here to stay, that we have survived, and we are not passive. We have much to offer the world. So listen to our voices and learn and celebrate, because so often the news is bleak. We have the highest poverty rate, the highest violence rate. And so people often think of Indians as being poor and marginalized, but we're much more than that.
Sarah Deer is a law professor at William Mitchell College in St. Paul and is an advocate for Native American women who are victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. She recently spoke on the UW La Crosse campus. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCullum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.